Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share with you all a little bit about the work we've been doing in Oklahoma. I'm very, very happy to be here. So I do have a little disclosure. After leaving Tulsa Cares, after being there 10 years and transitioning to OU, they said, please don't go. And so I do work as a paid consultant for the organization, which is a social services agency in Oklahoma for people with HIV. So as our other researchers today have illustrated just, I think, very beautifully with their work, is that mental health and stigma have very profound implications in the quality of life and health outcomes for people who are living with HIV. More recently, food insecurity has entered the radar screen as a social determinant of health that we should be thinking about with this population. However, we aren't really sure how all of those three conditions operate, but as we can intuitively see that those things might actually cluster and occur in the same individual and thus increase their risk exponentially for not only risk behaviors but negative HIV-associated outcomes. So as we've already seen today, the HIV treatment cascade is our framework of thinking about the care of HIV-infected individuals. Only about 30% of persons in the United States have achieved viral suppression. However, by the year 2020, we're striving for that to be 90%. So we have a very long way to go, and the social determinants of health, particularly the ones I'll be reviewing today with you, probably have a stronger role to play if we can integrate them into our programming. So just to touch a little bit on these three factors that I'll be discussing today, the first being mental health. We've known that mental health plays a significant role in adherence since the mid-1990s when a lot of the HIV/AIDS medications became released into wider use, where especially women in the earlier studies, if they did not have good mental health, they were less likely to be adherent to their medications. And if they received mental health services, that actually was shown to improve adherence to medications. More recently, there was a study in North Carolina that looked at the records of 1,400 patients in a particular practice, and it found that 12% had active depressive symptoms operating, and about 41% had a history of a psychiatric diagnosis, and there was about a 25% poor adherence rate in that clinic. So even today, with the medications being more easy to take and having fewer side effects, mental health still seems to play a role in adherence. Stigma, as discussed a little bit in the previous discussion, if a person's living with HIV, that's one form of stigma, but there's probably other forms of stigma that are going on simultaneously in that person's life that are influencing day-to-day interactions with others, regardless of people know their status. So there's always that concern often of HIV disclosure, but an individual might also have stigma associated with being a sexual minority or a gender minority, racial minority, that also is interacting, as well as the stigma of having a mental health diagnosis or having a past drug abuse history that person's consistently having to navigate. And that can have a role in getting tested, taking medications, and being retained in care. And then lastly, food insecurity has really started being studied around the year 2009 as it relates to retention in care. And we have seen in studies from the United States that between 24 and 71% of individuals living with HIV in various communities experience food insecurity, which is significantly higher than the national average of around 15% for the general population. So those were the three factors that we were considering as we designed this study. And so we knew that independently, stigma was associated with adherence. Independently, food insecurity was associated with adherence, and poor mental health was associated with adherence. And then from other studies, we knew that stigma and mental health were related, mental health and food insecurity and stigma, but nothing had ever looked at all of those things together to see what's really driving poor adherence and other associated outcomes in this population. So to tell you just a little bit about Oklahoma, that is the state right above Texas, and we have a statewide population of 3.9 million people, and we are considered a low prevalence state. We have about 5,300 people living with HIV in Oklahoma, so that translates to a prevalence rate of about 140 per 100,000 population, and about half of the individuals with HIV in Oklahoma receive care from Ryan White funds, which is administered through the state. So that's just to give you a little bit of an idea. I am from Tulsa, and we only have two urban areas in Oklahoma. We have Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and that's about 80% of all of the HIV cases are in one of those two areas, and the rest are dispersed throughout rural Oklahoma. So very recently, our own state health department did an analysis of a treatment cascade of persons who were recently diagnosed between 2009 and 2013. And what we saw is that we were doing a pretty decent job as a system for getting newly diagnosed individuals linked to care, but then we were not doing a very good job at keeping them engaged or allowing them to achieve viral suppression. So this, you know, underscores the need to maybe think about some more non-traditional approaches at keeping people engaged rather than just a traditional clinic service. So our research questions were to, one, just estimate what our state looked like in terms of the prevalence of food insecurity, mental health distress, and stigma, as well as medication adherence, and then try to see how those factors interrelated in the effect of outcomes along the treatment cascade. So our study design was cross-sectional. It was limited to individuals who were receiving Ryan White-funded care, and we recruited at all of the service providers that receive Ryan White funding in the state of Oklahoma. So that included two Ryan White medical clinics and two social services case management providers. And we actually just sat in the waiting room and tried to recruit as many as we could. It was between September 2012 and March 2013, so it was about a 5 or 6 month window. And for our survey completion, they received a $5 gift card to Walmart for their time. So our instrument included the basic demographic questions. We did have the case management or the medical staff actually confirm the patient's CD4 or viral load. They had to be in date within the last 6 months, so that limited our sample to those that were considered engaged in medical care. We also confirmed their diagnosis date with the chart. We used the 10-item food security survey module, which allows us to categorize persons as being food secure or not. And we used the Burger Stigma Scale, which is a 40-item, pretty long stigma scale that allows you to measure enacted stigma, disclosure concerns, negative self-image stigma, and concern with public attitudes. We used a single-item question that had been used in a previous study to try to assess self-reported medication adherence. And then we used the BRFIS items for physical and mental health measures so that we could make comparisons for our sample against the state. And then we asked what types of food assistance programs individuals used. So Dr. Dina Wheeler with Oklahoma State University assisted with all of the data analyses. I'm a qualitative researcher, so you don't want me to tinker around with numbers too much, but our analyses included descriptive statistics, bivariate correlations, chi-square, t-test, and odds ratios, and then we did some logistic regression and two-way ANOVA to try to tease out how some of these factors were related. So this is a lot of data on my demographic slide, but the general take-home message here is that our sampling was just a little bit older than the Ryan White overall population in Oklahoma. It was a little bit heavier for the 45 to 64-year-old category. However, our sample was very representative according to gender, race, and ethnicity for the entire state, so we were pleased to have that balance there. Due to some recruitment challenges, we had a little bit more representation from the eastern side of the state compared to the western, but we compared and we really didn't see a whole lot of differences demographically or questionnaire response-wise between Eastern and Western, so I'm not really sure that mattered too much. It was very representative by income, and our sample was just a little bit, sicker or had a more complex HIV medical history because there was a greater proportion of AIDS diagnoses in our sample compared to general. So we had some very, startling and sobering findings just whenever we reviewed the mental health status of persons in Oklahoma. So Oklahoma in general, not even considering HIV, has the 44th worst outcomes for mental health of all states. And so about 13% of Oklahomans in general experience frequent mental distress. And if you're not familiar with BRFIS data, frequent mental distress is a classification that's given if somebody says that in the last 14 or out of the last 30 days, if 14 or more of those days experience stress, worry, or anxiety, they're classified as having frequent mental distress. So 13% of Oklahomans have that anyway. We looked at the low-income Oklahoma population, and that's about 29%. And in our low-income sample of Ryan White consumers, it was 41%. So that means at least 2 weeks out of each month, there was a lot of stress, worry, anxiety being reported by this sample. The average bad mental health days for the state is 4.3, and our sample had an average of 14.4 days. In terms of food security, we saw a similar picture. So this chart here is showing you the distribution of what food security status looked like in our population, and 48% of our sample had very low food security, and by that that means that they're skipping meals, not eating, physically having hunger as a result of not having enough food to eat, which is astronomically larger than what we see in the general American population. Another 19% had low food security, meaning that they were having some nutritional compromise, so maybe not getting enough vitamins, minerals, overall protein as a result of not having enough food to eat. And then another 21% had a classification of marginal food insecurity, which means they answered at least just yes to one of the 10 questions that we had. So overall, 88% of our fairly representative sample of Ryan White consumers were struggling with getting adequate food on a regular basis. So we thought, well, maybe this is because of them just being low income as to why their food security is so poor. And yes, that's part of it. But what you can see here is that in the overall U.S. population of just general Americans, 45% of people who earn less than 100% of the poverty level are food insecure. If a disabled adult is living in that low-income household, it goes up to 50%. But in our SEB group that earned less than 100% of the poverty level, it was 75% had food insecurity. So we're thinking that there might be a psychological factor, whether it be mental distress or stigma, that might be playing a role there to explain that difference. We next looked to see whether frequent mental distress and food insecurity was associated, and indeed it was. So if you look at the far right column where it says very low, that's very low food security, and you can see that those who had very low food security had a disproportionate burden of frequent mental distress going on in their lives. And it actually ended up being that those that had frequent mental distress had 3.5 times the odds of also being food insecure. For medication adherence, it was actually pretty good. In our sample, we had 58% reporting excellent, saying that they never missed a dose, and another 22% saying that at least 80% of the time they took their medications. And so using the previous methods for the survey item that we used, the rest of the respondents were classified as poor adherence, which actually ended up only being 31% of individuals in the study. So our next step was then to see, well, how does adherence and all of these factors of insecurity and mental distress relate? And we saw that those who had poor adherence were disproportionately affected by food insecurity and frequent mental distress, and that these conditions were not independently related, as I said. So if you had frequent mental distress, you are more likely to also be food insecure. And so we put both of these things into a model to see how they both influenced adherence simultaneously, and we found that frequent mental distress remained the significant predictor of adherence, while food insecurity just dropped borderline out of significance. So while it's technically not significant, we had a small sample size, and we do think that food insecurity is still important, but that it's really frequent mental distress that's more driving this relationship. The next step that we did was looking at stigma differences, and what I just wanted to point out is that at least one element of stigma played a role in adherence, food insecurity, or frequent mental distress. However, food insecurity lit up for all of the domains that we looked at. And unfortunately, we did not look at social support, which really seems to be the theme for the day as being important. And we're thinking that social support might be an underlying factor of explaining why, if you have higher levels of stigma, you might also have fewer instrumental opportunities to get food assistance if you need it from others. So with our stigma analyses, we found that it was actually stigma and not frequent mental distress that had the main effect related to food insecurity. So the stigma scores for persons who were food insecure were much higher, as I said, compared to those who were food insecure. And it was specifically disclosure, public attitudes, and enacted stigma that ended up driving that food security relationship. So this is the picture that we now have with our pilot data, is that yes, all of these things are indeed related, and it's actually poor mental health that's really influencing the adherence differences, but that still stigma is associated with mental health, and food insecurity is associated with mental health, and food insecurity and stigma are indeed working here. But that really, if you can improve the mental health of these high stigma, food insecure populations, you're probably going to see better gains in adherence markers. So some considerations is that for any chronic illness that requires medication adherence, food insecurity and frequent mental distress are possible risk factors. HIV does add that additional element of making it more likely for a person to have food insecurity and mental distress, and this might be because of limited perceived social support or out of concerns that somebody's HIV status might be discovered whenever they go to seek food assistance. So some implications that we're really advocating for in Oklahoma is that persons who provide food assistance for HIV-positive individuals, there are a number of organizations that just have that mission nationally, that they really need to incorporate mental health screening into their systems of care, and that they need to have appropriate referral linkages, and that also instead of improving food insecurity through just episodic food assistance, we really need to think about rolling out structural interventions to improve food security in the long term, whether it be housing or employment. In terms of medical and social service provider implications, we know that mental distress is a barrier to linkage, but we also have to remember once these individuals are engaged, mental health is still very, very important. And we can't assume that their mental health is good just because they're technically in care. And we know that mental distress is associated with the higher levels of stigma, adherence, and food insecurity. And consistent with IOM recommendations that were released several years ago, we really need to implement food security screening and mental health screening regularly at these clinics that are delivering HIV services. Our findings point to the benefit and necessity of treating the whole person, and really speaks to the need to integrate mental health, nutrition into clinical care. And unfortunately, though, that's not how our Ryan White dollars are being allocated. About 60% of Ryan White consumers get access to medical care. However, they only get 14% use the mental health services, and only 11% receive food bank assistance services. And so we really need to look at how we're balancing out those dollars to better treat the needs of the whole person. And just to wrap up, our future research needs, as we've already discussed today, really needs to look at this role of social support in helping all of these outcomes. I just wanted to acknowledge the research team that really helped to put this whole project together, and our Ryan White agencies that allowed us to collaborate and go out and recruit among their patient population. So thank you.